Oh, it finally came out
right. Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
That was created by Trinity House Entertainment, Inc. And on June 27th, when I interview Tess Gerrinson, we have a really great announcement to make about what they're up to. And before I forget, I would be remiss if I didn't congratulate my niece, Katie Rose, on Straight A's like her aunt. This book that we're going to talk about, Evil Winds, is going to talk about the situation in Africa that people are ignoring today. Darfur, the killing started in 2003, and they're still going on now. It's the first genocide in the 21st century. And here to talk about it is the author of Evil Winds, Michael Shusko, straight from Japan. Good morning. How are you? How's the weather there?
Actually, we're preparing for a typhoon, Fran. But other than that, it's doing very well.
Yeah, we're preparing for a thunderstorm day, too. Not fun. Not as bad as that, though. Oh, wow. I don't know how you do that. So when you created this novel, why did you decide to focus on Darfur? And was this the basic, based on fact that Angie decided to go there and take a chance? Because we know these things are really happening. Why did you pick that particular place?
I write stories based on world events, current events, as best as I can. I try to study and analyze what's going on in the world, and I try to keep the settings and, to a large extent, the plots of my novels as timely and realistic as possible. The volatile situation in Darfur is still relevant today, as you mentioned, and unfortunately mostly ignored. As is a lot of what's going on in Africa. In a lot of my stories, the historical content that I discuss is accurate, as is the background of the plot. For all my novels, I focus on physical locations that I have, for the most part, traveled to or lived at some time in my life. And I try to weave in scenes or exchanges loosely based on real events or people that I've encountered as much as possible. One of the hallmarks of the Tradecraft series is its realism. I've read so many spy thrillers out there in the past where the protagonist does so many incredible feats, almost impossible feats. But I try to focus on the more realistic experiences and of people that I've met and or that I've worked with to try to keep it as real as possible. Although it is fiction, after all, I do try to take some artistic liberties.
Well, I got frustrated at times with the main character, and I'm saying that, why is she going to risk her life? Why is she going to do this? And I'm saying, I understood why. And the ending was really interesting. I won't say more about that. So when created this, why did Angie decide to go to Darfur? And then she meets, I have my review in front of me, Henry, and she's greeted and she's told that they're glad that she's there. Why did they want her there? What was her purpose of going to there and writing the story about the refugee camps? Did she think it was going to really help?
Well, so initially she wanted to write an award-winning story, and she has this famous parents in the literary world, and she's trying to make a name for herself. But she's also truly motivated by a desire to help people. You know, she's a very compassionate woman, and she goes to Africa to try to help. But she truly didn't know what she was in for until she landed and saw the horrors on the ground. Her idealistic view of Africa becomes more realistic after she meets some of the other characters in the story and experiences life there. But she truly did go there to try to help. And although perhaps her initial motivation was to write the award-winning story, her compassion truly compelled her to see the story through.
And she did. She did it in very dangerous ways, too. I began to get nervous about some of the chances that she took. So we learn about Africa and Chad, and I have my review in front of me. And Chad's goal is to help disease-inflicted people to have some semblance in life. How did he hope to do that, and why was he there?
So Henry Chesterfield, he's an experienced British humanitarian and politician who's lived in Africa for his whole life, and he works as the media coordinator for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Africa, and he's truly the face of the UN's mission at the refugee camps, and as such, he's Angie's point of contact in the camp. He spent much of his life in the region and truly loves Africa. He sees Angie and her work as a way of broadcasting to the world the atrocities that are occurring in Darfur, and he strongly supports her work. But as you mentioned, her quest to help the Darfurians and to write this story puts her in harm's way, and Henry's concerned about her naivete and her ambition, and tries to keep her grounded and safe while in the refugee camp.
Yeah, I know. She's brave. I couldn't believe that she actually went in there. So, once again, so she goes in, and she doesn't realize, and she takes a tour of the camp, but she doesn't see him coming. The Jahawi soldiers gun down the Darfurian refugees in cold blood, and I imagine they don't care. They're just doing it. What is their purpose of doing this? And this does happen today. That's what's even scarier, because it's all true.
Right. It's interesting because sometimes they become numb as well. You know, these bad guys, if you will, that have been doing this for most of their lives, ever since they were children soldiers, child soldiers themselves. They become numb to their own killing. The novel kind of tries to look, this one more than my other two, really tries to look at the bad guys, and you hear their motivation for what they do and their internal justification for what they do as realistically as possible. I try to portray that.
Well, you did. Sometimes I felt like I was shaking and getting nervous, because I didn't know what was going to happen. And at times I wanted to, you know, get up there and take out the bad guys too myself. I mean, that was crazy. So they have the jihad. You have, what is she? She insists on learning more about what happens to the boys and girls there. Why does she care? I mean, what help could she give them? And that's the sad part, that they didn't care. That first chapter was scary with those kids and what those evil winds were going to do. I said, oh my God. I thought, oh my God, and that really exists, I imagine.
Yeah, to a large extent. When Andrew heard the gut-wrenching stories from these refugees in the camp, you know, those stories had a profound and really life-changing effect on her. Once she viewed firsthand those atrocities, she really personalized their plight and became almost obsessed with helping the lost families of Darfur.
Yeah, I know, it's scary. So then she gets teamed up with Jason. Who is he and why is he there? And how do they get to work together? Does she mind having him around?
He's a young physician who works for a non-governmental organization or an NGO at the refugee camp. He himself had only arrived a few months before Angie, but he has been working there, taking care of the refugees, and he's really proven himself to be a compassionate and dedicated physician, and he had become very popular with the refugees and the staff at the camp. Like Angie, he's also driven by a desire to help the injured and oppressed. He has his own backstory where he has his own reasons for going to Africa because of some tragic events that has occurred in his own life. But he also has some of his own secrets and other motivations that are slowly uncovered as the story unfolds.
No, we're not going to give that away. So we meet Hussein, who I hate a lot. And he's in direct competition with his boss, Tawik, who I don't like, Tawfiq, and who I don't like either. That's even better. And he has his own agenda. And they want to form a new Islamic caliphate. How are they going to do that? I mean, that happens today too, right?
And
it's scary.
Yeah, so, you know, one important thing to remember is, yeah, these are bad people, as you mentioned. And, you know, every religion and every group has bad people and great people. So, you know, there are many Christian, Islamic organizations in the world that are incredibly peaceful and do a great job of unifying their members under a banner of peace. But Abdullah and Tawfiq, they're not in this category. They truly see their mission to really take over certainly the Middle East, if not have their eyes on, you know, larger swaths of land. And they do want to create a very strict society that is seen through their eyes, and it's not true Islam. It's based on their own personal interpretation of what they want to believe of their religion. And so they team together, and Abdullah teams with a couple of others, and he's been in a couple of other books earlier, and he'll be in some subsequent books. And he is trying to create a network of very strict, oppressive people that rules with an iron fist. And this is really where his plan starts to take shape in the sub-Saharan countries.
That is scary, because it's happening right now. It's even happening here. You don't even know. You don't see them. And you have no idea where they're showing up, and just anything could happen. So she chances dangerous situations. And who is Steve, and why does he keep bailing them out? He takes a chance too.
Yeah, so yeah, as I said earlier, Angie is kind of innocent. She had grown up in a loving, secure, supporting upper middle class family in California, but she hadn't experienced much adversity or danger in her life. After hearing these stories and seeing what she saw when she first arrived in sub-Saharan Africa, she wanted to do more. But she really was downplaying the dangers, really not understanding how dangerous her actions were, because she didn't have the experience in the harsh world. But she is still driven to get evidence of the atrocities that the Janjaweed were committing. And Steve, from previous books, he is still trying to track down the Abdullah al-Harbi and the UIC, and trying to keep them from creating this very oppressive, united front of like-minded people that will create a kind of oppressive state. And he crosses paths with Angie and Jason as they travel deeper into some dangerous land.
It's scary. So could you define, a lot of people don't know what a caliph is. How would you define that word? Somebody is considered the caliph. What is their job? What is their purpose?
So historically, the caliphate is the person that follows the prophet. So, you know, as the prophet goes away, these are the successors for the prophets in various religions, and in this case in Islam. And there have been a number of true khalifas, and they were good, righteous, religious men in Islam. Abdullah al-Harbi, he is misinterpreting this aspect of Islam, and he wants to be a successor of the prophet, and he's using that as a way to get other Muslims to band behind him so he can create this caliphate or this united Arab nation under his kind of tainted view of Islam, his misguided view of the religion. So he sees himself as the next successor of the nation of Islam, or the religion of Islam.
Yes, remember he's coming up against some very crazy people, Abdullah al-Haribi. No. So we have Yasser, Hussein, and we have Tawfiq. So who's the most powerful of all of them? And what are they trying to do? Besides the fact that Jahawis kidnapped the boys and girls in the first chapter and forced them into the army, and the girls are sold as slaves, and it's like, oh my God, this is horrible. And this really happened.
So Tawfiq, it does. It very much does in Africa and other places throughout the world. So you know, Tawfiq is an appointed governor, and he's in the Darfur, one of the provinces in Darfur, and he's a former Janjaweed officer that actually worked under Hussein in the past. But he has since turned to crime, organized crime, and other activities that are more lucrative for his personal gain. So he's an opportunist, and that actually puts him into conflict with Hussein, who feels he's trying to do this for, you know, the greater good of his people. As tainted as his view may be, as evil as it may be, he does. Hussein himself believes he's doing right, but Hussein is a fierce desert warrior, where Tawfiq is a treacherous crime lord. So they both are pretty dangerous in their own rights, and they do come into conflict with each other from an ideological perspective.
Well, not everybody who can trust you really can. And that's what's scary, too, because they believe somebody is really for them and he's really not. And that's not good. So who is Faisal and who is Ting, and what are they? They're part of this group too. They want to do something also.
Right. So Faisal Sadiq, he's Abdullah al-Harbi's right-hand man, and he's basically his closest confidant in Abdullah al-Harbi's organization or terrorist network called the United Islamic Caliphate, or the UIC. He has a kind of a supportive role in this story, but he will take a much more prominent role in the next book that's coming up soon. And then, as you mentioned in your review, there are some other bad guys and gals in this story. We see the face of the United Islamic Caliphate and the Janjaweed, but there are like many things in the world, there are people behind the scenes that are pulling strings, and they're slowly introduced in this book.
Why is it, this is just not on my list here, but why are we ignoring it? Why doesn't the United States, I mean, they butt into everything else, that, you know, places where maybe they need to not butt in so much, whatever. So why isn't anybody helping Africa? Why is that, I feel like that's the lost continent. How come nobody is doing anything about it?
There are, in all fairness, there are quite a lot of NGOs, and USAID has a lot of programs, and certainly some huge organizations, private organizations in the United States spend an incredible amount of resources helping Africa. We hear about the famous actors and actresses that go over there. But there are also so many incredible, this book is dedicated to the peacekeepers and the peacemakers, because there are truly so many wonderful people that are in Africa and throughout the whole world in crime and war-torn areas that are making such a difference every day. So I don't think not a whole lot is being done. I just think maybe the media focuses on other things that are maybe more sexy and not as help ratings But I do think a lot goes on, and there are some incredible people doing incredible things. And a lot of nations are doing great things, including the United States. So there are a lot of things that are going on that are helpful. It's just there are some bad situations in Africa and other places throughout the world that I just hope the world doesn't lose sight of.
I know, and I've read so many books about Liberia and Guatemala and Ghana and a lot of different places. I get everything, and it drives me crazy. And all they're concerned about is the fact that there's a book that was written by two people, and they're making a big deal out of it more than they should, and that's ridiculous. So, and I didn't read it yet. As we read more, we see Jason, Yasha, and Angie travel to the village where tragedy happens. How do they feel when they see all these people killed? And how do they get Halima? They find her. And why does she bother? Why does she trust them?
Well, because of all the horror stories that they're hearing in the refugee village and some of the things that they see with their own eyes, they hear the stories. Jason and Angie decided to travel to a volatile region and to kind of see for themselves what's going on for various reasons. And there they find a 12-year-old Darfurian girl named Halima, and they actually befriend her, and she ends up going with them on their journey of trying to figure out more of what's going on in the region.
Well, her brother is introduced to the army in chapter one. This scared the daylights out of me when that guy said, "Look at my face and it's going to look like mine." Matak has never been away from home, and they took him and they took everybody else. What do they expect him to do? And what's going to happen to them? Because he's not the only one. There's a whole bunch of them that are caught in this mess. I got so scared reading the first chapter. I said...
Well, Matak is Halima's older brother. He's still a teenager himself, but he's certainly significantly older. And he and his twin sister were taken by the Janjaweed early on. And through their eyes, we see kind of what his fellow and her fellow captives go through as both child laborers and forced child soldiers and forced laborers. So I kind of try to portray what's in his mind and what he might be thinking of as he deals with his Janjaweed captors and his transition from an innocent youth growing up in a remote village in Sudan to the horrors of becoming a child soldier.
That is so scary. And then you wonder if they ever get out of this or get safe or someplace else, if they can actually live with it or they need some help to get along with life. Or if they just, some of them, I wonder, do some of them actually believe what these people do and want to stay there and do that?
As I mentioned earlier, there some of the Janjaweed and just throughout the world, I mean, there are people that have been doing things that are unsavory or some evil deeds, but they've become so numb to it because they've been doing it for so long, and some people may even believe what they're doing is right. So I would imagine that it would be difficult being a child and being captured and forced into labor and forced to be a soldier and all you know is violence and war from that point on. The effects on the psyche would be devastating.
It's scary, just like the ISIS and all those places that actually convince these kids that they're going to be martyrs, and all they're going to get is they're going to become dust and nothing, and that their families are going to be taken care of, and they don't even know if that's the truth. That's what's scary, is that they're so brainwashed they actually believe this nonsense, and while they're sitting there collecting whatever, they're going to be dead, and they don't get it. So we learn about something else. What does the gold mines have to do with anything?
There are, like any conflicts in the world, there are kind of international forces that tend to shape events in war-torn areas, including Darfur. child soldiers, human trafficking, they all exist to an extent because there are those willing to exploit others for profit or for their own gain. And Evil Wind kind of shows a spotlight on international players that have a play in these horrible crimes. And, you know, gold is a very gold mining and the gold trade in the world is very lucrative. And unfortunately, where there's money and power, there are those that try to exploit to gain those that wealth. And and Darfur in Africa is one of the areas where this has happened, unfortunately.
This is scary. This is really scary. So why does Steve saves them again? And what happens to Jason when she gets Halima? But what happens to Jason? Because he risks his life too. And I got nervous. I didn't think he was going to come out of this either.
Now, Steve Connors, he's actually well known to tradecraft readers. This is the third book that he's in.
Yeah.
And he'll actually take a very prominent role in the next book. But he's a CIA troubleshooter. And he's kind of made it his business to track down leads on the UIC and Abdullah al-Harbi and try to find out what he's up to. And he gets clues and he has tracked them to Sudan. And as such, he's kind of crossed Jason and Angie's path. And he actually ends up rescuing Jason and Angie. And together, they kind of decide to kind of pull their forces together to try to do what they can to help the villagers in Darfur.
I wonder, I'm going to ask this at the end, I wonder if Angie had to do it again, if she would do it again, if she was so brave to do this. So they get detained. And what connections does Steve have, again, to get them out? And who is Mobasa? I liked him.
Yeah. So, yeah, Angie and Jason, they end up entering Sudan illegally. They have no visas,
yeah.
And they're captured. And when the Tawfiq, as the governor, and his cronies learn of Angie and Jason's motivation to help the villagers, they are not happy to have Jason and Angie in their country. So they have their own reasons to try to get rid of them. So Steve, as an agent of the U.S. government, has embassy connections with the U.S. embassy, and he has some street smarts and some credibility as a U.S. government employee with the CIA. And he kind of uses his skills and influence to negotiate their release, and then that's when they end up teaming up to try to pull their resources together to help those that are being devastated in this area.
It's scary. This is so scary. This is so scary because it could really happen. So what was Mobasa's role, and why did he, you know, the brother wanted to do something along with Angie and them to help the people. Why didn't he want them to help get the kids out of the gold mines? Well, that's if they could get them out of the gold mines.
Right. Mobasa is Halima and Matak and their other sister, Fatima. He is the father of these three children. Their village has been ravaged by the Janjaweed. And he, as the book unfolds, he plays a more and more prominent role as we mm-hmm. learn more about him and his own influence in the region. But he has his nationalistic ideology and trying to save his people that have been attacked over and over again by the Janjaweed, and he fights back. And then as his children disappear, he finds that he's fighting for a lot more than just his tribe, but also his family.
Well, who in I have the book in front of me. I keep scanning this thing and coming up with more things. Who on our side is helping them besides Jason And besides Steve, any of the government agencies that they're in touch with that are helping them, or could help them, or don't they?
So certainly Henry Chesterfield and the UN and the NGOs, there are medical NGOs that and the United Nations and organizations that, as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of them in Africa, and they're trying to help the situation, to help the lives of people, to help solve problems, to help work with the countries and the governments to make life better for the people in Africa. And there are a number of those organizations that pop up in the book, and they help our heroes as they try to make life better for those in Darfur, as well as Steve working with the U.S. government, an old friend, Karen from our previous book, Karen Brenner, an old colleague mm-hmm. of Steve, comes out to help out as well. So no man's an island, and it certainly takes more than Steve, Jason, Angie to get out of this mess and help the people of Darfur. And a lot of them are coming. They're reaching out, and a lot of these organizations are coming together to fight the bad guys, if you will.
Well, I was just going to ask about Karen because I like I said, I'm going through the book, making sure that I don't miss anything. So, Steve decides to set up his own kind of summit, you might say, between Mombasa and Tawfiq. What happens when the two of them meet? That was priceless. That scene was absolutely priceless.
So it, as a crime lord, if you will, Tawfiq is mm-hmm. an opportunist, and he is doing whatever he can to make a buck and to get ahead. And he crossed the wrong adversary when he crossed Mombasa, and he had to reckon with some things that he did, some terrible things that he did. With Mombasa and Steve, and Steve enlists Mombasa's assistance in finding some of the missing children of Darfur, and Mombasa is very happy to help that quest. And when they meet with Tawfiq, they certainly press him for answers on what's going on.
I can imagine, and he doesn't really want to give him any answers, and he thinks he's sort of immune to the world. I don't know, but I imagine after reading this, he's not quite done yet, and I have a funny feeling there's going to be a whole lot of more bad guys going coming out in this book. So, I like Halima's brother, and he allows both of his children to remain with Angie and Jason. Why does he trust them? I mean, these are Americans. He's the father of these two, and yet he allows them to go and do whatever they want to do. Why does he allow him to go, and Halima won't go anywhere without her brother, and he won't go anywhere without her sister? That's loyalty. So, but why does he allow them to go? And I was like, oh, my God, if anything happens to them, I'm going to be really upset.
Well, both Halima and Matak are, they're very impressive, strong, independent, mm-hmm. Young people, and they are thrown into, their world is thrown into incredible hardship when Matak is taken by the Janjaweed, and Halima sets out to help put her family together. But Matak plays a very pivotal role in the book, and you know, he highlights the mm-hmm. atrocities committed by the Janjaweed. He's also a hero who helps save his family and his neighbors and his villagers. Mombasa ends up, you know, he sees this in his children, and as proud as he is of them, he's also pained by the horrors that they've seen and that they were forced into adulthood and giving up their innocence by what they've been through in this book. But he's proud of what they've done for the villagers and his people, and he does feel that they can help Jason and Angie in their quest of making the plight of the Darfurians more known to the world. And quite frankly, he also feels that they'd be more safe with Jason and Angie and the Americans because he has his own battles that he's continuing to fight.
Just how dangerous is it where he lives, where he is? So he's worried that they're going to come in there and the Jahids and kill the people in his village too, where he is?
Right. So, he has kind of made it his mission to protect his people and the villagers. And Hussein and some of the Abdullah al-Harbi and some others are still on the run. They're still loose in sub-Saharan Africa. And yeah, he has a dilemma. He wants to protect his two children, but at the same time, he's committed to protect other villages. So he has to decide what's going to be best and safest for his kids. He certainly can't bring them with him as he fights the dangerous Janjaweed. Their villages are gone. Who else to leave him with while he's tracking down the Janjaweed that have destroyed these villages?
I'm looking at something on my phone. I'm telling you, I'm learning a lot. I learned a lot before I read the book. Now I'm learning even more. It says, and it comes out in the book, that the dispute is basically racial and not religious. The Muslim, Arab, Sudanese, and the Jahawid militia group systematically target, displaced, and murdered Muslim black Sudanese individuals within the Darfur region. Why? And the victims are generally from non-Arab tribal groups. Why is that? Because you would think it would be their own, but it's not.
Yeah, so I kind of talked about the history a little bit in the book as best I could. It, as you mentioned, it's not religious. As a matter of fact, a lot of the belligerents on both sides, the Janjaweed, the Darfurians, a lot of them are Muslim. Most of them are. So it's not a religious issue. It's, a tribal issue. The Arabs are nomads and they roam the deserts. And, as the weather changes and there's a desertification of North Africa, as more and more of the fertile lands are turning into desert, there's just less area for these Arab nomads to graze their herds. So the non-Arab villagers have been set up in these villages for a long time, and the nomads are kind of encroaching on their territory to really for in part survival. So it puts these two groups in conflict with each other over lands and resources.
That is so scary. And it's happening in other countries today, too. It's not just there. Not just in Darfur,
right.
But
true.
Other places, too. So, and then in this book, you show the many of the citizens fled the violence and went to the refugee camps, and they went to Chad. Why did they go there? Why did they feel safer there? And are they really safer in Chad, according to what I read in the book?
There are refugee camps. And IDP, or internal displaced persons camps. So if it's a Sudanese from Darfur going to a camp within Sudan, that's an internally displaced person, IDP, not a refugee. So they are in those camps, but there are camps also set up in neighboring countries across the border because those countries have allowed these refugees to come in to be safe because they have their own country and border guards where they can protect them. But unfortunately, the unstable troubles that have plagued Sudan for years have kind of gone over into these neighboring countries as well. And so these neighboring countries may not be as safe as they once were for similar reasons. So, but the camps, refugee camps, are set up wherever a country would allow it to be.
What about the leadership of Africa? What are they doing about it? Anything? Are they helpless? They can't do anything? It's like they're there, but they're not there. They don't do anything to help them. What do they? And it's just not brought out into the news.
Right. Yeah, I mean, most of them are. I mean, they're as I mentioned, there are some really strong leaders and governments and military folks and religious and political and social groups that are really doing Herculean feats in Africa. It's really just the few of the bad apples. And you know, this is a work of fiction, so I take some liberties with placing by placing bad guys in different positions in government and organizations. But most countries really do want to take care of, most leaders do want to take care of their people. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, there's not a lot of money because of some of the resource limitations and desertification and lack of resources in some of these countries. So there's not a lot they can do without a lot of external aid and a lot of external assistance. Most countries do what they can to help. Sometimes it's not enough.
I know. I was watching some of them about Syria and all of them, and I started to cry with noticing where these people live and that they're killing their own people, the government, and that they're poisoning them, and they're living outside in little tents and stuff, and these kids are starving. It's just like, oh, my God. So before I forget, next Thursday we're going to talk to Alan Jacobson, The Dark Side of the Moon. And those of you that ever want to know about the moon and becoming an astronaut, this book is really great. On the 27th at 10 Eastern, Tess Gerritsen takes center stage, and it's not a book. It's her movie. It's a horror, and I have to watch it, Island Zero. And watch out, it's an island where everything goes off and nobody can get off and everybody's getting killed. Then I'm taking the rest of July off and June off, and I start back on August 1st with the author of Hiding. On the 6th, the author of Tale of the Dragon. On the 20th, a phenomenal book about PTSD, Stephen Manchester's The Three Shoeboxes. And that's just some of what I'm going to be up to. And my show is booked all the way to November 7th so far, and December. But there are a few dates in between, and I hope to do a panel show, and I hope you'll come on it. When I do it, I want to talk about real-life issues in the news, books based on fact, not just fiction. Because there are a lot of authors out there that are writing books that are not historical fiction. They're historical fiction, but basically like this particular book on real-life issues. So if you had to pick the terrorist in the book that was the most dangerous, who would it be?
Well, in the Tradecraft series, the books take you through. Yeah, they take you through components of a terrorist organization. I mean, that's really what the series is about.
Yeah.
And from their weapons and tactics to those that back them and the motives behind their individual terrorists themselves. Eva Wynne kind of looks at the individuals and gives a peek into the mindset of a terrorist. What makes them tick? There are a fair amount of terrorists and bad guys in this book, from the UIC leader Abdullah al-Harbi, his right-hand man Faisal, to the Sudanese rivals Hussein and Tawfiq. I would probably say Hussein is the most aggressive and heinous of the bunch. But Abdullah, he's shrewd, and he's very feared for his ability to unite like-minded jihadists and recruit them into his efforts to bring about a global caliphate under his strict iron fist. So I guess I would have to lean towards Abdullah just because of his larger impact. But Hussein, he's pretty brutal.
Tell me about it. He is. So are there any, I have a couple more questions over here, but are there any groups that are against the genocide? Are there anybody on the side of the people to try to stop it? It says on the one side of Darfur genocide, there are two non-Arab native movements called Justice and Equality. Do they have any kind of help? It's a Justice Movement, JEM, and Sudan Liberation Movement of the Army. However, on the other side, there is a Sudan government with Sudanese police and military. Was there anybody that wants to help these people at all?
So the those in Darfur, kind of like Mubasa, have a lot of them have banded together to protect themselves and their tribes and villages from the Janjaweed and from anyone that's threatening their tribes and their lives and their families. There are those in the government certainly that are trying to help them. You know, there's a significant movement in Sudan and North Africa as a whole to bring the plight of the of those being oppressed to the surface and to do what they can to help. Certainly the UN, refugee agencies, NGOs, many, many countries, including the United States and you know, China has a lot of influence in that region, and they're doing a lot to help the people. You know, there are a lot of countries and nations and international organizations, private, a lot of foundations here in the United States that are doing a lot to help the people. But unfortunately, there are the bad guys too, and those bad guys are on the ground doing a lot of bad things, and it's their land, meaning it's their home, so they kind of have home court advantage, and it's hard to fight that from New York City and from Geneva and from, you know, other places in the world when the people on the ground are doing such bad things.
I know, not all of it is brought out in the news. You don't always know. But also you brought out in this book that when they capture the girls, they use them for their own pleasure. And they another cool aspect of the Darfur genocide is sexual violence against women of Darfur, especially young girls. So they sell them and they abuse them into sex slavery. And has that increased or is it stopping? Or are they stopping? Can anybody stop that? I mean, it's all over the world. Every book that I've been reading now is human sex trafficking and selling these girls and abusing them at the same time, even though they want to make money from them.
Yeah, I think, you know, with there are a lot of movements going on in the world now, in the United States and other places, to bring the plight of, you know, issues against women and more to the surface, and I think with that knowledge is power, and I think the more people recognize these bad things that are going on, hopefully the more people will stand up for women and for victims and, you know, against the perpetrators, and, you know, with the united voice across the world, hopefully, you know, these bad things will become extinguished. Certainly they're not there now, but yeah, you know, I have hope and faith that, you know, there's still good in people, and that goodness will prevail if the voices are heard and people work together to try to get rid of these bad guys and the bad things they're doing.
I
knowledge
really
is power
all over the world. I know. Well, people of Sudan, do they have any natural resources that they have, any minerals, or are they not available? And is that part of their problem?
There are. You know, we kind of touched on the gold mines in the novel, and certainly there are other natural resources that are valuable in that area. Sometimes that's a good thing, because if those resources can be harnessed and utilized for good purposes, it can help a lot of people. But it can also draw some unsavory characters to exploit those resources for their own good, for their own benefit. And that's, you know, may not be as good for the people of that area, that region. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. And some nations and some groups in the world have been able to allow their people to be enriched and benefit from those resources. Some, unfortunately, have not. So, it's a tough one.
It's scary. Now, if Angie, we're not going to say what happens at the end, but she learned a lot about herself, and she learned a lot about what happens to the people there. If she had to do this again, would she go and do it the same way? Or would she go back and do it? Would she help some more? Or does she feel that she's done all she can do?
I'm quite certain Angie would not hesitate, just like she didn't this time. She's a strong woman, and she's propelled by her compassion, and that has not been stifled by these events. If anything, her flame is burning higher to help. You know, although she may have gone in initially to write the next Pulitzer award-winning story, her what she saw on the ground is, and her compassion is truly what motivated her to her actions. And she might do it a little bit differently, because she is no longer the innocent, naive woman that she had once been. But I don't doubt at all that Angie Bryant wouldn't be doing the same thing over again.
I don't doubt it either that she wouldn't do it again. But I can almost wonder what was going through her head when she was, you know, when they were, you know, taken in and into custody. That was scary too. And the fact, what would have happened if they didn't? Would they have, you know, used her for something also? Because they're so crazy, these people. I don't know. But if the refugees
in
Darfur
could
speak out, what do you think?
I'm sorry?
No, what do you think? Would she, what would be going through her head? I mean, at the time that that's scary. What was going through her mind at that point?
A lot of the peacekeepers and peacemakers, they are truly selfless individuals that put their work above themselves. You know, they risk their lives every day. And like Angie, she wasn't thinking as much about what was going to be happening to her, but what was happening to those around her. And she would put herself into harm's way again and again. Not even thinking about how it would affect her because she was so focused on helping those around her. And I tell you, there's some brave men and women out there that do this every day. And they do it just to help. They do it based on their compassion. And I believe that in the face of adversity and evil, at the worst times of their lives, they aren't thinking of themselves, but they're thinking about those around them.
That is so amazing. That is so amazing that there are people out there, and I don't think enough people know about it or appreciate what they're doing or even know about what they're doing. So if the people of Darfur could speak out to our listeners, what would they hope would happen? How would they hope they could get help? What would they want everybody to know about them and hopefully that they would help if they could speak out and talk to us right now?
I certainly don't speak for them, but I would think anyone that have lived under these oppressive and dangerous events would just want to have a normal life. They would want what all of us want. They would want to have a life where they can wake up and, you know, have breakfast and laugh with their family and feel safe in their home and live with their community and enjoy life and make a world around them in peace. I would think that's what I want every morning when I wake up. And I think people across the world, for the most part, want the same basic needs of life and have the same basic needs. And I think they wake up in the morning just like I do and try to figure out how they can achieve those goals.
Well, I have to tell you that my nephew went to Japan last year with his girlfriend, and I have pictures on my phone, and they absolutely loved it. They loved the people, they loved the scenery, they loved learning about it, they thought it was fantastic, and they're going to go back, definitely go back. And they loved Tokyo. They thought it was absolutely amazing. So, I got all excited. I said, gee, you know, now I felt like I got to know where you are a little bit better. So, what is next for
Angie?
We
love Japan.
Yeah. What is next for Angie and Jason and Steve and these refugees? What's coming up for them? Are they coming in the next book? And what is the next book? And when is it coming?
Hopefully what's coming next for them is – you know, the peace and redemption that they are all looking for. And Angie, maybe some professional validation that she can make it on her own in the literary world. Matak and Halima and the other refugees, they want, as I mentioned, what we all want. They want to be with their families and return to their homes and make a home and start over again in a safe and free Darfur. Steve, there are other things in store for Steve. He's kind of the thread that ties all the tradecraft books together. The next book is The Fifth Column. It's the fourth book of the series, and that actually focuses on Steve and his stories. Like the other books, you know, you'll see some characters weave in and out, some of the main characters from previous tradecraft books will weave in and out of new stories, but each story is standalone. So Angie and Jason aren't going to have much of a role in the next book, but rest assured that other characters from previous tradecraft books will be seen again.
When is it coming out? Because I want to put it in my schedule, because I'm sure your publicist is going to contact me, because I don't have your direct email, so I have to go to Melissa for everything. So this way I know what I'm doing. Do you have a date when that book is coming out yet?
No, so since Evil Winds just came out, it'll be next year. Certainly, we still have to work on timing of the books, and there's a lot of production scheduling things that bigger minds than mine help me with on a daily basis. But I hope next year. The books of the series. The fourth book is the next book is the fifth column, and then there'll be two more after that. So it's a six book series. So fifth column will be out next year, and then I'll start wrapping it up with the last two in the series after that. And then I have some other books that are some at various stages of completion that are not part of the series that will be coming out soon as well.
Well, I have to know about it. And I hope that when I contact your publicist that you'll be able to do one of the panel shows. And I'll make everybody get up at 8 o'clock in the morning. You watch and see. And they will. Because this is great for me. But where can everybody find out more about you and your work? Because this has been enlightening. Let me tell you, I don't think enough people know about this. And I don't think enough children in school know about this. I mean, they know what happened in Parkland. My niece was, right there. And I know that a lot of kids are afraid about what's happening with terrorists, but where can everybody find out more about you and your work? Because this has really been interesting to me anyway.
So I have my website, www.michaelshusko.com, michaelshusko.com, and then my Facebook page, author Michael Shusko. And then certainly on Amazon, under Michael Shusko, my books are listed there as well as a couple of other places. But they can certainly click on any of those links to find out more about me, the books, and what's coming up.
Well, I can tell you that I posted your review, and about 10 seconds later, people read it. They read everything I write.
Oh, wow.
Which is good, because that's what you want. Everybody's reading everything that I write. Like 5 seconds later, they go, oh, my God, that's a great review. I got to read the book. I go, well, I'll go on Amazon and get it because, that's the only way you're going to. Actually, I have to tell you, be honest, there are like 5 people that want to read your book. And I told them to go on Amazon and get it. A lot of people, think it's a fantastic issue. But I want to thank you so very much. It is almost 9 o'clock in the morning here. It's 10 o'clock where you are, right, just about? 13 hours later?
Yep.
So if I contact your publicist, is there any specific month that is good for you to do a panel show? I've got some really New York Times authors that definitely will join me for this and some award-winning authors. And unfortunately, you never get to go to the Thriller Fest in the Grand Hyatt because that's where I'm going to be this year. Definitely.
Well, I'll be returning to the States actually soon, so I'll be in the same time zone as you, and B, hopefully I'll have more time. So I'd be honored to continue to work with you, and we'll have
Thank
to work
you.
On some times I'd be available.
Thank you. Well, whenever you're here, just let me know because there are a lot of authors here that would really be. Great. And it's too bad you're not going to be in the same time zone in July. The Thriller Fest, everybody, I'm going to be there from July 13th to the 15th. And I'm excited because a lot of people have been asking, are you coming? And I hope it doesn't mean that they're going to, well, it probably does mean they're going to hand me a whole bunch of books to review. But that's okay. So I want to thank you so very much. I appreciate it so much. Everybody, it's a beautiful day. And Father's Day is Sunday. You can go on Amazon and buy Evil Winds and a whole bunch of books for anybody, fathers, uncles, grandfathers, brothers, everybody. It's a beautiful, it's a rainy day outside. You're expecting a typhoon, that gets me nervous. But everybody stay inside and read. Thank you, Michael. Everybody have a nice day and bye.
Frank?